On this week's 51%, hear about a society editor who was among few female journalists, meet a woman who started a cooking school for veterans.
And I said, when I win the $10,000, I'm going to start a veterans cooking school in Rochester, New York, where I live.
And two Millers honor a traditional food craft. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Have you heard about Dear Blanche? Got run down by an avalanche.
No.
Don't worry, she's a game girl, you know. Got up and finished four.
This kid's got guts.
Having a nice time? Grab a line.
Have you heard that Mimsy Star?
Oh, what now?
She got pinched in the Astor Bar.
Sauced again, eh?
She was stoned.
Well, did you ever?
Never.
What a swell party this is.
During the New Deal and World War II, Washington elites turned to Hope Ridings Miller's column in the Washington Post to see what was really going on in town. Cocktail parties, embassy receptions, and formal dinners were her beat as society editor. I went as a guest, said Miller, in hope that they'd forget I was a reporter. In the book Washington's Golden Age, Albany Times Union reporter, critic, and author Joseph Dalton chronicles the life of this pioneering woman journalist who covered the powerful vortex of politics, diplomacy, and society during a career that stretched from FDR to LBJ. After joining the Post staff, she was the only woman on the city desk. Later, she had a nationally syndicated column, and for 10 years she edited Diplomat magazine, and then wrote three books about Washington life. And Joseph Dalton is her cousin. 51%'s Joe Donahue asked Dalton how long he was fully aware of Ridings Miller's accomplishments.
From childhood. Okay. I never grasped the real extent of her contacts and accomplishments until I began on the book. But I remember growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, her books on the coffee table in my grandparents' house. So that's telling you how long I knew about her. Her name was always said with a certain reverence in the household. Cousin Hope.
Cousin Hope. When it comes to you then deciding to write the story, was that something that in your mind was always a foregone conclusion, oh, well, I will do that someday, or a very deliberate thing of saying, you know, this really needs to be done?
It was when I moved to Albany in 2002 and began writing for the Times Union that I was struck with the idea. I was not a writer before I came to Albany, and I was lucky enough to make a connection at the Times Union and find a gig that worked for me. And I realized, oh, there's some other writers in the family. My mother was a journalist. And then what about Cousin Hope? And I had never read her books. I got her books and began reading and was very taken both with her style and also the fact that her first book, Embassy Row, The Life and Times of Diplomatic Washington, she wasn't writing from historical sources. She was writing firsthand knowledge. She was there for the things she was writing about. And I was like, wow, this would be a good project to write Cousin Hope's biography. And again, that was 16 years ago.
So is it easier or more difficult, realizing you've never done this before, but is it easier or more difficult, do you think, to write about somebody that you have a familial connection with, or starting from scratch and saying, I'm going to investigate this life of a stranger?
I think it was easier because I knew her. I went to college in Washington in the early 80s, and so I was in my late teens and early 20s, and we became friends, and she was in her late 70s. So I always knew how the book would end. The last chapter is our relationship. And so I think it was easier. There was a grasp of the personality. I struggled at times to find information about points in her life, but I always knew who the woman was, and that helped a great deal.
When you think of the accomplishments, you know, I think of this in a war setting. I know my father fought in World War II, and I just knew that growing up, but I didn't really understand what that meant until I started to hear the stories and I grew up, and then you understand what that is of, oh God, what he did, which was quite amazing. Was it the same way? I mean, you had those books on the coffee table, and then suddenly you look at this life and you think, oh wow.
Exactly.
You put that into a context.
Yes. Getting down into what it really meant. I knew she was society editor for the Post, and I knew she wrote three books. And she repeated that to me, but she never told me about how LBJ liked to kiss her on the cheek. She never told me about being 33 years old and maybe it was 36. So she was in Washington only a few years. She was still in her 30s. And her husband had dinner in the White House family quarters with the Roosevelts. That's something you talk about in your life. And
right.
She, maybe because she had just done so many of those kinds of things, she never told me about them. And we had many meals together. So it was definitely a gosh once the research began.
When you're in a job like that and you've done that, even when you're in your 70s, are you still basically doing that even though you may not be the society editor of the Washington Post?
She maintained a social presence well through her 80s in Washington. So she wasn't coming home in the next morning writing up the
right.
parties she went to, but it was in her blood to be part of to be out there on the scene. And I benefited from that. She just liked to go out and about. She called it going about. And I was a music student at Catholic University, and she came to my recitals. And that was really sweet of her.
What was it like? I mean, let's not forget here that, the subtitle, the second part of the subtitle of the book is The Rise of Women Journalists. So she's at the forefront of this. How many women were working for the Washington Post when she started?
I don't have a good answer to that number, but when she started, Eugene Meyer had just purchased the paper, and one of the ways he was making a distinction and rebuilding it, and let me say, we all know the Washington Post today.
Right.
It's the survivor of the Washington newspapers, and it became famous during Watergate. In the 30s, it was in the number five out of five newspapers. So it was not a prestigious gig necessarily, but they needed talent. And she began writing in the women's pages. Usually the women's columns in major cities were syndicated, what we call wire copy. Mr. Meyer hired a team of women, and Hope was one of them. She did that for about 3 years, and then she was on the city desk. The only women, here's some perspective for you in terms of numbers. When she was on the city desk for 8 months, she was one woman out of with 50 men.
Wow. Did she talk about that at all, about what that was like? Again, I put it in a context of what that was like.
No, she did not get into much details of things like that, but she did make clear that she was not a women's liber. She said repeatedly in interviews and things that I found that she never faced discrimination, and she was very much of the mindset that women should do less demanding rights and do it working hard, and that the rights will come. And she became very popular in the party scene because she had a nice sense of humor, and she had little bon mots that she liked to say. And one of them was, I don't believe in equal rights for women. I want special privileges. And it's a cute saying. In terms of whether she faced discrimination, though, I found a couple of things that went against her argument that she never had any difficulties or impediments because of her gender. And during that period, she was on the city desk. She said one of her jobs was to go to check the drawer of her editor's desk to make sure he had a bottle that would last him through the night. And if there wasn't enough to drink, she had to go across the street to the liquor store.
Oh, wow. Oh, there you go. Yeah, Mike does that for me. She started, you tell this early in the book, but Kay Meyer, right, is becomes Katharine Graham and was one of the people who was working on that woman's page.
She was the copy girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
talk about, obviously she's the publisher's daughter, but she's working from the bottom up, right?
Exactly. The little appearance of Kay Graham, the future great Kay Meyer, as she was known then, and who became the great Katharine Graham, it's one of many walk-ons and bigger appearances of tons of famous people that are in the book. Along with covering the party scene, Hope covered the various celebrities that came to town. There's Mary Pickford, Spencer Tracy, Walt Disney are all in the book. When the Royals came in 1938, I have a whole chapter about the garden party. The story of the Royals and the Roosevelts going to Hyde Park and sharing hot dogs is well known. But a couple of days before, there was a garden party at the British Embassy. And there was a hullabaloo of who got on the guest list. It was very exclusive, even though there were 1,200 people. So there's all kinds of great names and great moments in the book.
When it came to those invitations, she was invited because, there was a trust to know that when she was invited, she would be able to
report.
Convey and report what was going on in what they would see as a positive way, I would say.
Yes, she said it was generally speaking, society editors were supposed to put the best spin on anything they could. If she was invited, it was with an understanding that she was a reporter. And one of her friends, there weren't many friends left by the time I was writing the book, but one friend said, if you saw Hope at a party across the way, you generally knew it was going to be written up. However, she, as you read in your introduction, she functioned as a guest. And I was lucky enough to work from an oral history that had been conducted, and it was a great interview over 5 sessions with her. And she says, I never carried a notebook. It would have thrown off the whole dynamic. But she did have a little notebook in her bosom, and sometimes she'd run off to the ladies' room
like
and
do.
Whip out a pen and paper and take down what she just heard.
So if Senator fill-in-the-blank gets schnockered and puts a lampshade on his head, that probably isn't going to get reported.
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah.
There were some others who did that, and it became more of the thing, but Hope would not have done that kind of thing.
Right.
She was a lady, and that carried over into her writing. She had a dignity, and she had a respect for people. And that's one reason the book is called Washington's Golden Age. What a contrast do we have today? She and her peers, not just the journalists, but the powerful men in the city, conducted themselves with dignity. Maybe there were some lampshades along the way, but they weren't rushing out and telling all the secrets right away.
But you think of the time of even Roosevelt going to his grave without many people knowing that he had polio. You think of, it was well known in Washington that President Kennedy had affairs, but that was never reported by anybody. Yeah, it's a very different time, and she was operating really under those rules.
Exactly. She said in the Kennedy chapter, there I have some quotes from her. She said there seemed to always be a Kennedy scandal about to erupt every week, something new. And the hostesses were one of her great focuses. And she said the number one hostess was always assumed to be the first lady. But Mrs. Kennedy basically took a year off from being first lady.
Yeah.
And there was an absence of leadership in the social scene. And that didn't exactly show up in the writing. She continued to put the best spin on it. But I think an absent first lady has a little bit of a parallel to today of how little sometimes we see of Mrs. Trump.
You have to think. You have to think. I thought of this while I was reading this book. I can't imagine that you didn't think of it while writing about it. Oh, my God, what would Hope make of what's going on in the city that she loved today?
And I don't have a good answer for that. I think she would be aghast. It would be beyond words. She kind of withdrew from the day-to-day life of Washington, covering the day-to-day life in the 60s, and when things got coarser and they were out in front of the White House saying, LBJ, how many boys did you kill today?
Right.
Even that, I think, made her shrink back. I think she would also, though, want to know, so this is the course of life in Washington, what's happening in the social scene? And I think a stronger social scene leads to more camaraderie and good feeling and cooperation.
I think you make a very good point, and we'll have to end with this, but I think you make a very good point in the book that tell me if my assumption here is off base, but it seems that many people dismiss the society column and think, oh, well, that's just, okay, that's fine, that's gossip, that's this or that. But that's the engine of the city, especially at that time. And that's when things happened.
Exactly. She said the social scene is where Washington does business. I'd also like to make a case, though, that back in the day in the mid-century, every newspaper had a society reporter, and that was often the means or the entry door for women into journalism. So it's the early jobs of women are not to be discounted and forgotten. And for Hope, though, she was a society editor of a different sort because she was covering the powerful and elite on the social scene in Washington during the war when the city exploded with life and the government became what it is today.
That was Joseph Dalton, author of Washington's Golden Age, Hope Ridings Miller, The Society Beat, and the Rise of Women Journalists. He was speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue.
What a swell party. Swell party. Swelling and elegant.
Military service can change the way you eat. You have to scarf down your meals in basic training and survive on MREs or meals ready to eat when you're deployed. Some veterans get out of the military without ever learning to cook. So a program near Rochester, New York is helping veterans build a better relationship with food and a sense of community. Sarah Harris reports.
Tacos, salad, chicken wings, chocolate-covered apples, sherbet punch. It's all on the menu for today's lunch. A small group of veterans is learning how to cook, and the kitchen is hopping. Chef Ellen Adams darts around, helping people make their dishes.
And these guys are working on the chicken legs. They have tossed them in flour and olive oil.
Adams served in the Air Force for 20 years. She went on to culinary school and became a personal chef. But she wanted to do more to help veterans. And then she got the opportunity to go on the reality TV cooking show Chopped.
And I said, when I win the $10,000, I'm going to start a veterans cooking school in Rochester, New York, where I live. And everyone went, oh, it's so great.
But Adams didn't make it past the first round of the show. She got chopped.
I was so mad. I'm like, how could you chop me? I can't believe this. Here I am representing the United States Air Force.
But that didn't derail Adams' dream of starting a veterans cooking school. The night the show aired, she got a text message from a stranger in California, a woman who donates to veterans' causes.
It said, hi, Ellen. Veterans are my passion. I want to give you the $10,000 for your cooking school. And I was dumbfounded. I'm like, who is this? I thought it was like my cousin trying to punk me, but I'm like, I don't recognize this phone number.
It was legit. The donor wrote a check. Adams knew she wanted to host the program at the Equicenter outside of Rochester, New York, where they raise and train horses and where they were already running therapeutic horsemanship and farming programs for veterans. Adding food seemed like a good fit. A lot of organizations, including the VA, do cooking and nutrition programs for veterans. But this is one of the few that emphasizes the communal value of food. Nate Bush was one of the first veterans to come through the program.
What I experienced was a bunch of veterans getting together again and feeling that camaraderie that I had missed for 10 years. And we were eating food and working together and preparing the food from seed all the way to harvest.
Bush works for the program now, and he says growing and cooking food gets veterans invested in what they're eating.
You know, that food is special. You know, it's you know where it came from, and you know what you did to bring it to your table.
Today, veteran Chuck Dill is chopping carrots from the Equicenter's garden.
Some of these are for salad, and some of these are going to be for, like, a dipping. Like, when you get your chicken wings at the restaurant, you got your celery and carrots.
Dill says he really didn't know how to cook or garden before this, but that's not the whole reason he's here. He served in Iraq and Kuwait and got injured. He walks with a cane now, and it's hard for him to get around.
Kind of keeps you at home after a while because you're always in pain. You can't move around too much. This gives you an excuse to get out and be around people that understand what you've been through so you don't feel judged by people.
Once the food's all ready, everyone loads up their plates, squeezes around the farm table, and digs in. It's relaxed and fun. There's something so human about sitting and eating together. Meal by meal, veterans here are starting to heal, and they've got some delicious medicine. I'm Sarah Harris.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Milling flour is an ancient art. While commercial industrial milling has largely taken over, there are some who are continuing and honoring the traditional craft. In this piece, we meet stone millers at Carolina Ground in Asheville, North Carolina, who talk amid a traditional milling song from Cameroon.
There's something very significant, I think, about two women running this flour mill. I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's there. And the fact that it's so ancient, what we're doing, and that we're two women doing it.
I think it's the emotion and the intuition, and just being connected.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Lapidus, founder and general manager of Carolina Ground.
I'm Kim Thompson, and I'm the miller.
Stone milling, this is the original method. In fact, before that, there was stone on stone.
It is an ancient art. It's, if not the oldest, one of the oldest forms of mechanized production for creating food. So I can't not feel intrinsically connected to history.
I always remember one of my early jobs in college was I was working as a lab tech for an archaeologist, and one of my favorite things to separate out when they'd come in with a dig was to find a mortar and pestle. And it's that basic in a certain level, like, oh, just crack it into flour.
I just think about the story of the wheat that we bring in and where it's been and feeling responsible for continuing it and where it goes afterward.
Why are we doing it? I mean, food security, the fact that our industrial food system is based on cheap fuel, that's a finite thing. It makes a lot of sense to start rebuilding these community food systems.
You can't not pay attention to what's going on. Time, temperature, touch.
On this front end, you're seeing that this houses the stones, and grain that is fed through the hopper directly through is our whole grain flour, and then we have a bucket elevator that will carry that to a set of screens that will create a sifted product.
Even the packages themselves, the bags, we write by hand. It's the littlest thing, but I love writing the date that it was milled. I do that with a Sharpie by hand.
What you see now, most modern milling is done with steel rollers, and it's a process known as gradual reduction. The steel rollers are separating the bran from the endosperm and the germ, and they're gradually reducing it down to extract the starchy endosperm flour. For industrial food production, it was a win-win. It meant that you could have vertical integration and centralization of bread wheat production, and the shelf life was suddenly not a problem.
I like to randomly write quotes on bags of flour, especially when I'm stacking pallets, to kind of hide one in there, like little Easter eggs. It could catch someone's eye and make them think more about what they're about to do or what they're a part of.
Before all of that, pre-late 1800s, our country was dotted in stone mills, community mills, and it was more of a craft than an industry. When you're milling intact and the germ is crushed into the endosperm and all of it is coming through together, it's spreading those oils through the flour so you can really feel it.
It really is a huge contrast if you actually touch it. It just feels almost like it's creamy. It's crazy to me that the whole other process is to actually remove things and put it back when it's already there.
It's amazing to me sometimes when I look at the ingredients on a loaf of, you know, wonder why they call it bread, you know, that kind of bread where there's this list of ingredients and, you know, the idea of enriching our flour, coming back in and putting nutrients in when it was all pretty much there, basic, simple.
I feel like once you have experience with something like this, you can't really go back.
I think people are hungry for heart and for authenticity. I think that's part of what we're delivering.
I think a lot about how my life totally depends on the faces of people I will never see. I wouldn't even be standing here warm in this cold weather without people that I'll never know. It's a chance to get to be a part of something that connects people.
Since this story, Kimberly Thompson has expressed her preference for beer over bread, and the Marine is now raking malting grain up the road at a malt house. They ought to be in pictures, more. A study organized by Time's Up, the organization formed to promote gender equality, has found that female-led films consistently outperform male-led movies at the box office. The study analyzed the 350 top-grossing films worldwide released between January 2014 and December 2017. Researchers found that in films with small, medium, and large budgets, all averaged better global grosses when a woman was listed as the lead star. The study, conducted by the talent agency Creative Artist Agency and the tech company Shift7, found that films that pass the Bechdel test do better as well. The Bechdel test, an invention of cartoonist Alison Bechdel, rates whether a movie features two female characters having a conversation about something other than a man. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% Archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1537.